Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 0 years of law enforcement analysis experience, but he plays one at the Burlington Police Department in Massachusetts. He has 29 years of law enforcement experience. He is currently the president of the Massachusetts Association of Crime Analysts, also known as MACA. And until tomorrow, he is the president of the Police Futurist International, PFI. He is a law enforcement analysis influencer, the Massachusetts man, the professional problem preventer. Please welcome Glenn Mills. Glenn, how are we doing?
Good. How are you?
I am doing good. I gave you a lot of nicknames there. Mindy's not going to be happy with me because she's got to pick one now.
Yeah, I get a lot of nicknames here too. Usually they're not nice.
All right, Glenn, how did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
So I believe I had read about it in a few different books and seen reference to it. As a young patrol officer, I guess it was a while ago now,
yes.
I couldn't help but think, you know, we drive around randomly and we're doing a lot of random stuff. Has anyone ever looked at all this stuff and decided maybe we could do a better job, maybe do things a better way? I knew that people had done crime maps before. I'd seen that. I just figured maybe we could be a little more analytical. Maybe we could think a little bit more rather than running around and just doing things randomly. So I would read the log. I would see what calls we had, where they were occurring. I tried to pay attention to what was going on in cities and towns around us. Believe it or not, when I started, email was still almost new,
mm-hmm.
you know, as far as being used in our police department. That's hard to believe. But yeah, we started getting emails from other cities and towns every once in a while about things were going on. So if I knew there was a series of, say, car breaks happening overnight or house breaks on the day shift or whatever in surrounding cities and towns, I knew that, oh, maybe I could be looking for those things during the times that I was working. And then maybe we could look at what was going on and every once in a while note where these patterns were popping up. And then that culminated with me. Finally, I saw a couple of house breaks and it was right in the neighborhood that I grew up in. And I grew up on a nice, quiet, dead-end street. You know, my older brother and sister, their generation, there were a lot of kids in my neighborhood, you know, 8 or 10 years older than me, and they actually created something called Bike Town. Bike Town was a whole series of paths in the woods all around our neighborhood. And it came out in certain spots on our street. And then as my generation grew up, the kids, there were a lot less kids, but we still, you know, back then you were allowed to play in the woods when you were a kid. You don't really see that today, but back then we spent a lot of time there and I knew where all those paths were and I knew where all those things ended up. And I see these house breaks one day. I notice one, which I'm thinking, okay, that's normal. But then I see another one nearby. And then I saw a third one and I put them on a map and I thought back to my childhood and I thought back to where all those pathways went, where they came out. And I said right away, oh, this is somebody using the woods to approach these houses. It's not your typical house break that we would have in this area where somebody drives up to the driveway and then goes into the house. It looks like they're probably using the woods. So I drew that map and then I started writing down the dates and the times and the time of day and figuring out when it could have possibly occurred. And after looking at that, I said, it has to be probably middle school kids or high school kids, because typically, you know, the house breaks we were having at that time were drug addicts, which they still are. And oftentimes those would be earlier in the day. Well, these were occurring a little bit later in the day. And that told me that it was probably kids and just, it wasn't super sophisticated and just the area that it was occurring in and the times and everything else. I said, it has to be kids. So I drew my little crime map on a piece of paper.
Are we talking about 8.5 by 11 piece of paper?
Yeah. 8 and a half by 11 piece of paper. I had an outline of the street and the surrounding streets, mapped them all out, you know, color coded it in days and times, time of day. So I went to the detective lieutenant at that time and I said, hey, I think that this series of house breaks are kids in this neighborhood occurring between these days and times. And I think we should be out there looking for these kids, maybe in plain clothes, you know, here, maybe like, I forget what day it was, but like, let's say next Monday at 2:30 PM, I think would be a good time to look for them. So he said, oh, okay. Yeah. He thought about it for a while and they didn't get back to me for a while. And eventually those kids were caught doing a house break in the next town over in that time period. And it turned out, sure enough, they were kids. They were middle school kids. They had done all those house breaks. Everything I said was accurate about them. And I even went so far as to say, I think it's probably more than one kid, just based on some of the things that were going on, like the heights of the windows. I said that probably one is helping boost the other one up and things like that. I just sort of did like a little profile based on the information that we had reading all the reports. Unfortunately, I didn't get to be the one to go out and catch them, but it turned out everything I said had been accurate. And I said one of them probably lived in the neighborhood. That was another thing that turned out to be true.
It sounds like it wasn't taken very seriously when you went to the supervisor.
Yeah. So it wasn't something we did back then. It was just, it was just kind of like, oh yeah, that sounds logical. And okay, maybe I'll see if we can get some overtime and maybe you can go out and do that. But in the meantime, they had actually caught the kids. So that yeah. series ended.
So do you still have the map?
Yeah, actually I have it somewhere. I think I might have even taken it. So yeah, I do have it somewhere.
Okay. If you have it, I definitely want to put it in the show notes for this episode, if you don't mind. I think that's awesome.
Believe me, it's nothing advanced. It's literally like it was a dead end street and it was like all around the dead end street. So comparing them to the other house breaks in the town at that time, I said, this is one single series. And they were kind of like in Home Alone, the Wet Bandits. You remember them?
Yes.
Well, they had a little signature where they would flood the houses.
Yeah.
Well, these kids, their signature was not quite so clean and nice. It was more like doing a number two on the floor somewhere.
Oh, man.
So that made it pretty easy to say, yeah, we know it was you that did all of these.
And you can connect them all together.
Yeah.
Man.
But like I said, nothing advanced, but I just thought looking at a series of crimes like that, nobody on these different shifts, because they get called in at different times, right? So the day shift gets a call and they go, oh, it's a house break. And somebody just takes a report. And at the time, nobody would talk about it. In roll call, you know, roll call, they would talk about the Red Sox and, you know, back then they weren't good, you know, things like that. It was very, very little talk of crime and patterns and series. It was mostly talk of, you know, what car do you want? What lunch break do you want? Complaining about stuff and talking about the details that they got, the overtime work out directing traffic, which is really abundant up here. So that was the focus of everything here. And then to actually start talking about like crime and problems and reducing those things wasn't really an exciting topic to a lot of people.
Yeah, I find that time period fascinating. That's before my time. And so we're talking about the 90s now. When I had Eric Pisa on, we talked a little bit about Comstat. His idea was that Comstat's no longer needed because when Comstat was first created, it was solving a problem of getting the data out, getting people to talk about the data. And now data is so prevalent and reports are so prevalent, it's truly no longer needed, as he would argue. So it's fascinating as you talk about it, at this time wasn't data driven and data was not being discussed at all.
You know, we look at policing and a lot of it's driven by the big cities, but that's not policing in the United States, right? There are over 18,000 police departments, right? Mm-hmm. Most of them, the vast majority of them, have less than 40 officers. I'll guarantee you, a lot of them aren't talking about crime and things, and a lot of it is doing the same stuff they've always done. And that's not always bad. You know, we're good at responding to calls and taking care of problems, and some departments do things well and some don't. But I can almost guarantee if we went and visited roll calls all around the country, like we get a bus and we do a cross-country tour and we stop at every police department along the way,
It'll take a long time.
It's going to take a very long time, but guess what? What do you think is going to happen? We go into roll call and you start saying, hey, how many crimes do you have going on here? How many crashes? Where are they? When? And they'll all say, oh, I know that. We know that. We don't, you know, we know that. Oh, do you have an analyst? No, we can run a report in the computer. We don't need an analyst. And that's, I think, what you're going to find in most of the country. And anyone who wants to disagree with me, I'll fight them on that. I'll
So not only, I think we just created two reality shows there. One where we bust the country from police department to police department on roll call, and the other one of you fighting people. So
yeah. We'll thumb wrestle. But yeah, I think I'm right, because I just, you know, when you get to travel around, you get to see what people talk about, what they're doing. Some police departments are really into it, policing, and some of them are just really focused on arresting people and catching bad guys, and that's fun. That's awesome, you know. But some are also, they're complaining about union issues. The chief of police in a lot of departments, how often are they really thinking of all this stuff? They're bogged down with administrative things, with grievances from unions. They're fighting their city managers, the politicians. They're dealing with the horrible things in the news, the photocopy machine, the way people are parking in the parking lot and they're not gassing up their cruisers. Do you know what I mean? Like that's kind of largely what people get wrapped up in. And then you get into a habit of that's what you do and that's what you've always done. And then you're busy. Maybe CompStat, yeah, maybe we could get rid of it in some places, but in the places that never had it, or maybe the places that just started doing it and started changing their culture, you might want to keep it for a while because it changes the habits, right? Mm-hmm. And you're talking about crime and problems and crashes. If you stop doing CompStat, you're going to fall back into whatever you were doing before, right?
Well, I think Eric's point was like they should be doing that automatically. They should know their stats. They shouldn't have to go to a meeting to learn what their reports are saying.
Yeah, I know CompStat, yeah. I hear from a lot of places where it becomes like a homework assignment.
Yeah.
The command officer is like, you better know your stats. And then they're studying the night before. But who cares if they know their stats? Because they get all these problems, but they're not thinking about, hey, here's a problem. Let's address it. How are we going to address it? And then are we going to follow up on it? Like CompStat has to be about follow up too. But I don't know. We've never done CompStat here. See it as being something that would take off here right away and anytime soon. But I just know from observing and watching what's going on out there, a lot of departments, they're doing something called CompStat, but it's not really. Right.
Yeah.
And the analysts, I know a lot of analysts listening will go, yeah, that's true. Because they have to sit in these meetings, recite all these statistics, and then nothing gets done about it. Right.
Yeah. So
you all know
it's just one thing after the other, week after week after week. And when I was in Cincinnati, there was a growing bet between the analysts that no one ever did this, but they wanted to actually show the same data 1 week after the next to see if anybody would realize that the data was the exact same from the week before.
That would be fantastic.
So then from your case there where you drew the map, how did you then grow into getting into more problem solving and taking on that role at your police department?
So I got promoted to sergeant in 2001. And as you might imagine, it was a large event that year that sort of changed everything,
mm-hmm.
policing. As a result of 9/11, there was a big push to all of a sudden do all these things in policing that a lot of departments hadn't done. One of those things was analytical work, let's say, right? And maybe a part-time analyst at best. Maybe an officer could get overtime to do some of that work. Well, our chief of police at the time, he put out an email and he was intending only to send it to patrol officers, but he had accidentally sent it to the command officers as well. So when he said, hey, I'm looking for someone to get involved in doing this stuff called crime analysis, there's a conference coming up in May, Mass Association of Crime Analysts. And, you know, if anybody's interested, let me know. And he got one of our officers, Jim Tiggs. He retired. He's a selectman in Burlington now, but he still works as a part-time officer. And he was interested for the patrol side. But then I said, hey, chief, I actually know what that is. You know, here's a list of books I read. I understand it. And I really want to get involved with this. And I think we could do some good things. So at the time, that particular chief, he didn't hate me at that time. So he said yes. And you know, that would change later. He said yes. We went to the MACA conference, and that was 2004. So from that point on, I was a sergeant. I was on midnights my first year, and then I went to day shift the following year. So 2004 on, I was involved with MACA. And about 2 years in, I guess, I don't know what, I talked to enough people there that a few people said, hey, you should run for one of the office positions, the executive board positions, vice president, because I think you'd be good at, you know, that particular role and that setting up training and the monthly meetings and things like that. So I said, okay, yeah, I put in for that. And, you know, somehow I got elected vice president of MACA.
They haven't got rid of you since.
They haven't gotten rid of me since. Yeah. So that was good. And I just really found that community of talking to people who are interested in crime analysis, and they're also interested in a lot of other things. And it's really the smartest people in law enforcement and policing. I don't even call it law enforcement. I mean, we don't really do, it's not our primary thing is law enforcement. That's one of the things we do, right? Policing, but good policing. If you want to do good policing, then you should have some kind of analytical work behind it so that you're not just spinning your wheels and doing ridiculous things that don't work. But yeah, that was a really good, that was a really good move for me. That really helped me a lot.
So then what kind of problem solving, or I guess issues that you tried to tackle in the beginning?
So a lot of it would be things like series. If we had a series of breaks, trying to figure out when and where those breaks would be and where people should go, and also crashes. So we had another case where it's close to where I grew up again. And I looked at a couple of breaks, and about the third house break, I said, this is somebody I think who lives in the area. So now we had fancy computers, and I could actually knew how to use Google Maps, and I knew how to do a spreadsheet. And I started mapping those house breaks and the days and the times and all these other things. And I said, I think this is clearly a guy on foot. So then because I had taken the tactical crime analysis class with the IACA, I said, oh, this is one of those ones you could actually do that little box, right? You draw the box and you can actually figure out, make a prediction on a map, right? On a grid. And I had done that. And I said, the next break is scheduled for these days, around these times, and in this area. And it turned into, eventually, it got up to, this guy did like 16 house breaks, right? It was absurd that we couldn't catch him. But based on all the things that I was seeing, I said, this guy is going to be somebody that you won't even expect when you see him. Probably a male, could be a female, but they're not going to look, they're not going to stand out in any way. People are just ignoring this person. They're smart. They're very smart. Some of the things that they did showed me that I think they were experienced. Did a map of all of the people that I knew of who were drug addicted and doing crime. And there were a lot at that time in this area. So many, it was just really surprising.
Now, was this a hand-drawn map or did you use a computer this time?
On a computer. Not like Esri or anything, you know.
MapQuest.
Not MapQuest. Map. So I started kind of plotting where all these people lived, and then started going through them. Can we rule this one out? Yeah, this one's in jail. You know, this one got arrested in another town that day, and so on and so on. The one I missed, and what turned out to happen was by the 16th break, they were listening to me. They were adding extra plainclothes people all over the neighborhood. They were looking out for this guy. They did catch this guy right after he did a break. And he had a whole bunch of jewelry in his pockets and was sweating. And he was somebody, it turned out, he got out of prison. And the first house break he did was a couple of houses away from his mother's house where he was staying. When I did my map, the center point of that map with the longitude and the latitude and everything else, I put a marker there, and it was in that house's yard. Like it was a couple of feet away. The center point was a couple of feet away from that house. Like not like hundreds of feet. It was a few feet away. It was pretty amazing. And that turned out to be accurate. And some of the other things that I had said about him, I said he's probably small of stature, just based on one of the breaks. He had climbed up some lattice, which, you know, if I tried that, I would have broken it. But I said, this guy's probably small, but he's very smart, which turned out to be true as well. He might be riding the bus up to Lowell, Massachusetts. That turned out to be true. So I made some predictions just based on, you know, what was happening and the breaks and the things he was stealing, small items, jewelry. I said it's probably someone who's drug addicted, feeding their habit. All of these things turned out to be true. Of course, the court, after we arrested him, was nice enough to release him immediately, as they always do. And we caught him subsequently doing, he did another break, and we actually caught him. He changed his MO, changed his pattern a bit, jumped off of a bus a couple miles away, heading towards Boston area. And he did a house break there, but we actually lucked out because the victim had come home, saw the smashed window on the back door, called 911, and he was still in the house. So we caught him in that backyard. And then the detectives, when we first caught him, they actually used my map and all of the things that I wrote down in the interrogation of him. And he was nice enough to say, oh yeah, I remember that one. And then they'd refresh his memory on something that he forgot. And he said, oh yeah, yeah, that's true. So they did actually use it, and it helped convict him. So as far as I know, I think, and this is a few years ago now, but I think he's probably still in jail. He turned out to be a guy who was kind of dangerous too. He had a violent crime that he'd gone to prison 4 years earlier, but the analysis worked. People were really surprised how accurate it was. Unfortunately, we really haven't had any perfect series like that since then, where you could put it out to the troops, hey, the next house break is going to be here at this time. Haven't had any of those in the past few years. But the next time it happens, I'll be ready and I'll produce that for them.
Yeah, so it sounds like, too, you're getting into, I don't know if this is a bad word anymore, profiling. Had you taken any classes on that, or is this just something that you're picking up as you're looking at the evidence?
No, I hadn't taken any formal training, but I have read all the books like John Douglas, Robert Ressler, probably 6 or 7 books just on that topic. I found it interesting. And the way of thinking, it's really more like a way of thinking. If you look at, I don't know if you ever heard of Amy Herman, she teaches police officers to look at things and be more observant based on looking at fine art. So she has The Art of Visual Perception. She has a book out. She's a great speaker. I've been trying to get her to come to MACA for years now, and I email her every year. She says, no, one day I will come, but she just hasn't had the opportunity because she's always booked up at other things.
Sure.
But it's looking at things, being observant, and then you can draw conclusions based on what you're looking at. And the profiling that you want to do is more behavioral profiling. Like when I hear profiling in the news, I cringe because I'm thinking, oh, they're going to talk about racism. That's not profiling, right? That's just outright, hey, someone's black or someone's this or that. They're a criminal. And that's not profiling. Behavioral profiling is when you look at something and you say, okay, based on their behavior, we suspect some criminal activity. So that's the guy walking down the street, ringing people's doorbells, but he's only going to the houses where there are no cars in the driveway. And then when someone does open the door, he says, oh, he's surprised. He's not selling them, right? And then he goes, oh, wait, I'm a landscaper. And yeah, I'm looking for business. And he makes up some bogus story. And then he keeps going. Well, that's the behavior. I don't care what he looks like. It doesn't even matter what he looks like, his age, his race, his gender, none of that stuff matters. But what I can tell you is based on his behavior, that's a profile of someone who's probably thinking about doing a house break because it's just unusual behavior, right?
Yeah. It's also about the evidence too, because you hit on it before when you were talking about the person with the lattice, right? Yeah. The evidence, you didn't see any person per se. It wasn't necessarily behavior, but it's what the evidence is going to suggest because you realize that, hey, there's only so many people that are going to climb that lattice without breaking it.
And the thing I could say about his appearance for sure, for certain, and even in the old map that I did on paper, I could say for certain, these are people that don't stand out, that people are going to see them and think it's normal because, you know, we're in a suburban community with relatively low crime rates. So if you see something unusual here, you might call the police, right? If you see something really off the wall, you're probably going to call. Or now, actually, I'm sorry, they won't call. They're going to post on the resident Facebook pages and talk about the suspicious dude who was like doing weird stuff in their neighborhood before they call us, right? But back then, we would call the police. They'd say, yeah, there's somebody here and I can't describe, but it's just really weird what they're doing. Like, I want to hear about that. Mm-hmm. Because I have had people call up and say, oh, there's a guy walking down my street and he's black. And I've literally told people on the phone, listen, we're not sending a car to that. Okay. And they're kind of taken aback. I've had two times now over the years where I've told people, I didn't directly call them a racist, but I kind of said, hey, if this person wasn't black, would you be calling us? Can you look at it objectively and just tell me what they're doing? What are they doing? Oh, well, they're just walking down the street. Oh, okay. You know, thanks, racist, but we're not going to send a car, you know? So profiling, I have a problem with, as the term is used in the media, but it's a very useful way of looking at even some of the mundane crimes, right? Things like house breaks and things like car breaks. Like you know certain things. Like if we see house breaks here, you can tell, is this someone who knows what they're doing? Or could this be kids who have no idea what they're doing? Or even this, how about this is staged? This isn't a real house break, because sometimes people will do things they'll see on TV and then they'll think this is what it should look like, but they'll stage it to look like a crime and it's really not. And they're doing it to cover up some other stupid thing, right?
Or collect the insurance, right?
Yeah, that would be like a stolen car, right? We've had people do that where, oh, my car got stolen. And then, you know, you find it's crashed somewhere. Like there's a profile, right? Yeah. Oh, your car was stolen by a bad driver who decided to crash it, not where you said it got stolen from, but in your neighborhood, right? You know what I mean? Like you see that sometimes too. People will do that. And I've had a few times where, you know, one time I actually talked somebody out of filing the stolen car report. And said, hey, how about you just tell the truth and say you crashed the car? And then that way, you know, you're not going to get in trouble for insurance fraud. You'll only have to pay a deductible and not, you know, state prison, stuff like that. Yeah. So, yeah, there's a use for profiling, but it has to be heavily, heavily, heavily based on behavior. And it's not something you get to use every day, but it's pretty fun and cool when you do get to think that way and use those skills and draw some conclusions.
So coming from being sworn and then doing analysis, you have an interesting perspective. So what would you wish that more sworn officers knew about analysis?
That's a good question. So I would say that we can't always assume that we know everything. Like a lot of officers will say, oh, I know where the crime's happening. I know when it's happening, but you can't oftentimes possibly know that. Sometimes you'll have things going on other shifts. If you go away for vacation for a week, you're not caught up on everything. You can't even today, we can't even read all of the emails that we get. You know, I get some 300 or 400 emails every day. I just quickly scan them, but I seldom have time to read everything that I'm seeing regionally, right? We're lucky in this area. We have somebody who just, their job is just to share information in this area. And they were a retired detective lieutenant from the town next door, and now they work for the State Police Fusion Center. You can send this guy your, hey, we want to identify these people pictures, and then he forwards it out to like 1,000 other people, right, including detectives and officers who signed up to be on this list. So officers, I would say in our area, I would like them all to make sure they sign up for that distribution list and that they look at those things. I would like officers to know that if you have an analyst to use them and go to the analyst yourself. Like if you want to be a superstar in your police department and your police department thinks police work is important, because some don't, but if they do, you go to that analyst and become friends with them and get information right from them, your chances of cracking that big case are going to go up exponentially. Because the analyst is going to tell you all the stuff that they're telling the command staff that might not get filtered down to the individual officers. So you might be privy to, oh, hell, here's a series of house breaks and it's been happening in this area. Here's a series of sexual assaults that have been happening in regionally. And I know to look for this guy in this colored car doing these three things. You know what I mean? You could, mm-hmm. you could actually, your odds of getting something big, getting a really good arrest in your career are going to go up quite a bit if you're friends with your analyst, if your department has one.
Let's go on the other side of the coin now. What do you wish crime analysts would think of or consider on the sworn side?
I would kind of like think like a marketing person, right? You don't have time to get everyone's eyeballs. So it's very, you're almost competing, right? You're competing with all these other things. So if you're going to do a weekly bulletin, for God's sakes, don't make a 36-page bulletin, all this information in it. Don't make lots of charts and stats and tables. And if people are asking you to do stupid stuff, try to push back a little bit. Like, hey, chief, you know, I did that 160-page report for you, but it looks like nobody read it, right?
Yeah.
Why are we doing this? Can we make this a one-pager? So the times that we've had people working here that have actually, we've never had a full-time analyst, but we've had people working in administrative positions that were able, or even a dispatcher too, that were able to do some work on putting together a bulletin. And we would do a weekly bulletin. And I would say, whatever you do, try to keep that bulletin down to about 2 pages, because anything longer than that is useless. No one's gonna read that. Just make it really, and put in lots of pictures, because people like pictures. Make it interesting, don't make it boring. And stick to the stuff that's really important. You're like a TV commercial. Right? What do people do now when TV commercials come on? They fast forward through them, and They're not going to stop that TiVo button unless they see something really interesting. Maybe they'll stop and say, oh, wait, what's this? And they'll actually watch that commercial. So yeah. I would think like a marketer. Think like marketing, and what can I do to market myself? You know, I know a lot of analysts have taught this in different classes and put out publications about this, but it is really important to be thinking like that all the time. You're marketing what you have. And if you want to be a great analyst, maybe it's not as much about like, hey, I can do this fancy formula that will show the probability of this event occurring. No, that's nice. That's cool. But, you know, you want to catch eyeballs. Like, here's the one page bulletin that's going to get the patrol officers out there hunting this bad guy down. Like, that's what you want to do. Right.
Yeah. I also like what you've described already, which is getting into the behavior, looking at the evidence, getting more of what's beyond the computer. That's always a suggestion that I had. Get up from the computer, certainly know exactly what the crime scene and evidence is telling us about the case. And you've already done a couple of stories already on how you were able to leverage that.
Yeah, and I would say analysts should try every chance they get. Do a ride-along, get out there with the officers, go to roll call. Some departments, the analyst is up by the chief's office and they're hanging around with the chief all day. Yeah, that's nice, but how about, you know, try to meet some officers, sergeants, lieutenants, whoever's doing the roll calls. You know, talk to them whenever you can. Hey, Sarge, you know, here's a bulletin. I don't know if you're interested in this, but make it like their idea, right? Yeah, Sarge, here's a bulletin, and wow, it'd be nice if, you know, the guys knew this was going on, and they knew to be in this area of this sector in these times, and maybe they'll catch these guys, right? And that's the kind of thing you do. You're always doing like marketing and public relations and making friends with people, more than networking, right? You have to do it in your own department. You have to build relationships with people so that they trust you, and you have to have some trust for them, and then they're more likely going to share information with you and hopefully see your talents, and then realize that the information you're giving them can help people and then help you spread that information.
Let's talk about MACA now. We had mentioned it earlier. You have been either vice president or president of MACA for 15 years, 13 years, whatever it is, but certainly you've been president for the last 10, which is quite impressive that they must like you up there if they keep voting for you.
Yeah. It's funny because, well, analysts, they tend to be not as aggressive sometimes. So maybe there are people thinking like, oh, I could run for that. Like I've often thought maybe I should just step down and let people try for that position. Maybe we need some change. I don't know if I'm doing the right thing or not. I mean, I think MACA's reputation is really good. And that's not because of me. It's because of the people before me, especially like Rob Starring and Chris Bruce and Deb Peel. Those are the past presidents before me. Starring was a Waltham police officer. Chris Bruce, of course, everyone in crime analysis knows him. A lot of people know Deb Peel. They've done some great work. They taught me a lot, and they gave me a lot of good ideas as far as like running MACA goes. Chris Bruce, he said something years ago to the effect of, you should always be trying to, you know, help people and do things for people and not expect anything for your own career, right? Like, we're here to help people. I've done that. Like, I don't expect anything from anyone. I'll go out of my way to help anyone who asks, and I don't expect ever to even hear back from them. I don't care. Like, I'm here to help, right? Nobody owes me anything. Deb Peel, one great thing she did, she taught me to ask people, right, for favors, because of the way she's done things, we've had some big name speakers at MACA over the years. When you look at our lineup, our keynotes, some years we've had 4 or 5 keynote speakers, and each one of those speakers would be somebody who on their own would be the keynote speaker of a conference. And we're lining up 4 of them for 1 year. She was able to do that just by asking. Like she would call people up, and she wasn't afraid to say, hey, we have this conference, and it'd be kind of cool if you could come out and speak at it. And of course, we're not like paying people like big money or anything to come, but they just do it. And I've had a few people over the years where I just ask them over and over and over again until they're available. Maybe they just did like they're tapping out. Okay, enough, right? I'll come to your conference. And I've done that over the years. And I learned that from Deb, that you can actually just ask people and don't be afraid to ask. And you'll get Bill Bratton, and John Miller. And one person I asked year after year, and then finally she had an opening in her schedule, was Cynthia Lum. A lot of people know her. Fantastic speaker, a lot of great ideas there. So those are the things I got from some of the people before me in that position.
Now, on the MACA website, do you keep a running tally of all the speakers that you've had over the years?
Yeah, we have it somewhere. So I usually send my email pitch to the people we're trying to convince to come and speak. I should put that on the website somewhere, shouldn't I?
Yeah, I'd like to put that in the show notes so people can see all the list of guest speakers that's been at MACA conferences. So when you look back, what are some highlights, or is there some, one or two things that you're most proud of?
I would say the things I'm most proud of are we took our conference and we expanded it to a 5-day conference. We did that before the IACA did that. We used to have a 4-day. We made it a 5-day. We fill that whole week up every year with content. We're successful every year that we don't lose money. Our membership has gone up. We changed from our website to a member management system years ago. That was a good move because it helps you keep track of all your members, and then dealing with money. That's something I'm not at all interested in, but you have to do it. And you have to be able to manage all those things. So having a member management system makes that very easy. And it also makes it very easy to have your members renew, because that's a problem in a lot of professional associations, is that people will join, they'll sign up. But when we used to do things manually, it was kind of hard to like remind people, hey, you know, your membership's lapsed. Can you pay your dues? Can you do this? So having that member management system helped us increase our membership. And I want to say when I started as president, we were somewhere around 100 members, give or take. And I know the last time I looked a couple of days ago, we're now about 174 people that we have listed. So I think that's a success. The biggest challenges I have are just keeping people engaged. It's been very hard with the pandemic. We just had our first in-person meeting we've had in quite a while. So it's nice to get back into in-person meetings, because I feel that in-person connection and that networking is really important. And another thing I'm proud of and my involvement with all of this is that I put people in touch with other people that were able to help them and help each other. I think that's important, because I've been really lucky in that regard. I have a large network of people now that I know. And when somebody comes to me with something I don't know, I know somebody who knows the answer to that, and I can direct them to the right person. So that's another thing I'm pretty proud of.
Now, did you have to cancel the last 2 conferences?
Yeah, for COVID. So our timing was awful. But I think we made the right decision. Now I know we did, in hindsight. So when they were first talking about this pandemic, I would say it was January 2020. We could see it coming. And then I was reading different reports, all those emails I get that include some intelligence bulletins and things like that. And what I was starting to see was, oh, here's the pandemic that we've been talking about for years now. We knew it was going to come one day. I said, well, based on this being kind of like a flu-like pandemic, it's an airborne virus, based on what happened in the past, if you look at the 1918 flu and how things played out, I said, I don't think we're going to be able to do anything. And I probably wouldn't plan any major life events until about July of 2022. I said that here at a staff meeting, and people thought I was nuts. They're like, oh, yeah, this will be a few weeks. It'll be fine. I said, no, it's not going to be fine. This is going to be a big deal. It's going to be a big problem. And then when we were talking about it with MACA, it looked like, okay, it's spreading to the U.S. now, but maybe they'll hold it off enough so that we can still have the conference, and then, you know, maybe we'll be okay in 2020. But pretty early on, I said, nah, I think it's looking bad. I don't think it's going to go forward. And then when they had the state of emergency, I want to say somewhere around March or so, early March, we said, no, we're going to pull the trigger and cancel it. If you run a conference and you don't make your numbers at the hotel, you get hit with a big bill. And we certainly don't want like a bill for $10,000 for all the hotel rooms we were supposed to fill.
Yeah, because you're normally in the spring, right? The conference?
Yeah, we're in May every year. So then the problem comes in 2021. As 2021 is approaching, now things are starting to look a little bit better. We have vaccines, COVID rates are going down. But when you look at the trend and you start drawing a line, you can look at it and say, wait a minute, it's going to take police departments a little longer to be ready to send people to training than what the, you know, at what point it is safe for them to go. So we decided to cancel May of 21 as well, because we just not quite there. If it had been like, say, June, July, everything opened up again here. But May was just under that wire. Luckily, we had made a contract with the hotel that we were going to. We wrote that in there, sort of a COVID exception. So they, and this was funny too, because this was the first year. 2020 was the very first year we had moved the conference in decades. We had always been down on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, in Hyannis, Mass. But the hotel had become so run down and disgusting, we had to move it, right?
Yeah.
But we found a great place in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And for those who don't know, Plymouth, Massachusetts is where the Pilgrims landed.
Plymouth
Rock, right? Everyone thinks it's this giant rock the size of a mountain. But it's not that big. When you see it, it's literally kind of like it's a boulder. Mm-hmm. It's not even a big boulder. It's a boulder. But anyways, we were gonna be in Plymouth, Massachusetts in 2020, which is actually the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims.
Nice.
And that all went to hell, right?
Yeah.
So we had the first year contract with that hotel. The Hotel 1620 is what it's called. Luckily, we had a little disaster provision in our contract. So we were able to get out of it. But we said, okay, we want to come back next year. And then the next year we said, okay, we have it in our contract. If COVID, it's not safe, we can postpone for one more year. So now in 2022, we're going forward no matter what, barring a major tsunami on the East Coast or some other unforeseen disaster. We are going forward in 2022. And I do hope, I know a lot of people, whenever I see them at IACA conferences, they all tell me, I heard the MACA conference is awesome. I've always wanted to go. I'll tell you right now, this is the year to go coming up, because it's going to be great. Plymouth is cool. It's a historical New England town. We're literally a short walk from the harbor, or harbor, as we say here.
Yes.
You walk down to Plymouth Harbor and you can get yourself a lobster dinner and have a good time. And MACA, we always do have a good time. We're a very informal group. Of course, we have our trivia night every year, our world famous hospitality suite every night. And it's just going to be an excellent event. We have some great speakers lined up already, including Gordon Graham. He's always excellent to see. So I would tell people, this is a great year. 2022 will be the year that you're going to want to go to MACA.
Now, don't you also have a tradition about going to the Brazilian steakhouse?
Yes. So that was the most painful part of leaving Hyannis, because this place, I mean, I found it years ago back in 04. I was actually getting trained as an instructor in the RAD Kids program, which is like a self-defense and safety program for children. And this local police officer tells us, you got to go to this restaurant. He says, they come out and they bring meat, skewers of meat. Then they keep feeding you meat. And then they cut off meat. And then you keep eating meat. And then he's telling us this. And we're like, this is like a fantasy. Like, this can't be. Oh, it's meat. It's wrapped in bacon. It's injected with cheese, all this other stuff. And we're like, wow, that sounds incredible. So we went and we're like, wow, this is the best restaurant ever. It was a Brazilian steakhouse. We didn't have a lot of those around here, right? So back then, this was like, wow, what a find. And it was a very small place at the time. And every year they've grown bigger. So 2004 MACA conference, we kind of convinced a bunch of people to go down with us. And we could walk from that hotel. And it turned into a tradition where we went every year to Brazilian Steakhouse Night. Yeah, that's the one thing, the one thing I'm really going to miss. You know, the people at the hotel were really nice in Hyannis, I have to say. The staff there, I liked them a lot. They were great to work with, but that hotel just got too run down and it just wasn't something we could do anymore.
All right. Well, hey, it sounds like 2022 is going to be a great conference. So we will put more information in the show notes about that so people can look forward to that in May.
Yep. Go to macrimeanalyst.org is our website. It's always the week of Mother's Day is when we traditionally have our conference. So that Monday after Mother's Day. So May 22, it's going to be the week of May 9 to 13.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on now. Hey, let's talk about you being president of Police Futurists International, at least momentarily. I know they're talking about getting a new president and you're moving on, but I am not familiar with this organization. So let's first start, like, what is this organization and what are its goals?
So, yeah, Police Futurists International, I can't even remember. It was so long ago. I came across this. Somebody had written something. And I saw this thing about futures and police futurists and the futures working group. I said, wow, this is really interesting. What fascinates me about policing is, you know, we spend so much time in the present in policing. And in fact, we spend a lot of our time putting out fires, right? We're always reacting. Mm-hmm. We're always behind the eight ball. We're always a couple of years behind sometimes with different trends and things happening in society. People are like, oh my God, I didn't see this coming. Well, of course you should have seen it coming. Everyone else who's thinking about this stuff saw it coming and predicted all of these things. So I really like this idea of kind of going beyond strategic thinking and thinking about things, trends, and different things that were coming at us so that you could be prepared for them. So I joined this group, Police Futurists International. It's mostly, primarily, just interesting discussions on their email list. And it's people with all these great ideas and different things that, you know, sometimes they debate different things like, well, I think this is going to happen, or no, I think this is going to happen. And the topics are just really wide ranging. And sometimes they're really out there. And sometimes they're really, you know, pretty, you know, predictable, shorter term things. But it's really something I enjoy. So I chimed in on a lot of these different email conversations. Some people, I guess, in the organization noticed. And they said, you know, you seem to have a handle on a lot of things that would be helpful for us, you know, and you being involved as a board member with MACA, some people had heard of MACA and they were like, wow, it's really impressive. And then also in, you know, what you're doing with social media, I do a lot with that. And some of the ideas you're talking about, you know, I think you'd be great if you were the vice president of PFI. So I said, yeah, I'll do that. I became the first vice president, and the terms of PFI, they generally would run 1 year, and then it was kind of an automatic replacement. So if you're the first vice president, then you move up to president the following year, and then you're the past president the following year, and somebody else moves up. So I got into that rotation. But of course, me being me, I said, hey, why don't we extend these terms? I think 1 year is a little short. So they made it a 2-year term. So I'll be president for 2 years. And then that turned into now we're going to change our bylaws, change the organization of the association, and we're going to transfer it to a new president. And then if we do vote to change the bylaws, it'll change the structure of the group. But I can say that PFI, initially a long time ago, it was a larger group and it did shrink over the years. And then since I took over, we've been able to grow a bit again. And that's somewhere around the 170 mark as well, just over 170 members. We were down to around 100, and then we've been able to grow again. So I got us on some social media channels and did a little work to advertise it. But again, COVID really screwed up my plans. I was hoping for more growth and more change, but kind of got held back by that. And it's an interesting group because it's not just police. We have a lot of academics, and we even have people, sometimes you'll say, whoa, what is this guy? He's like a colonel in the Army. You know, and the Army and the military, a lot of branches of the military, they do futures research, futures thinking. Or you'll find people in the business sector, they're thinking about futures and looking beyond the horizon. You know, they look at the trends today, look at the past, and look at where things are going, so that someday they know, like, hey, we know in the future we're going to be able to sell a lot of this product because there's going to be more demand for it. Like, if you look at global warming, if you thought about global warming in the 70s, you would have said, hey, you know what? Maybe invest in sunscreen today, you know, maybe invest in air conditioning companies, you know, things like that. And those companies that were thinking that way in the 70s are still here today. And those companies that weren't thinking of that, they were thinking like, oh, we're just going to keep doing the same thing we always done. Those companies are gone now. So in policing, we don't have that kind of competition. Like, no other police department's going to come in usually. I guess sometimes sheriff's departments can compete against locals, but you're generally not going to have someone come along and compete with you and say, hey, we're ready for the future and you're not, you guys are done. But police departments should be thinking about this stuff. Look at social media, right? I was arguing with people here about social media back in the days of MySpace. I wanted to set up a MySpace page and I got a lot of pushback like, no, you can't do that. You know, we shouldn't do that. And this is just a trend and a fad and it's going to go away. Or some people thought, oh, if you're on there with the Burlington police on MySpace, the kids are going to know that we use it in investigations and it's going to tip them all off and then they're going to leave it and all these crazy, crazy things. And I said, no, look, this is coming. This is the future. Kids are on it today, but in a few years, everyone's going to be on it. Everyone's going to be on some social media. And I think pretty much I was right.
Maybe not about MySpace, but yeah. Not about MySpace.
I did try to get on Facebook back then, but you had to have a .mec or a .edu email account in order to get on there at first. But I did see that trend coming. I said, okay, Facebook, that's probably going to be big. And then probably the next one could be, like when I first heard about Twitter, I thought it was stupid. It sounded like a stupid idea, but then I got on there and started using it. And I said, wow, this is a really great tool for police. And it turns out that I think Jack Dorsey was inspired by police to create Twitter. He, in fact, worked for a software company up in this area that did like police and fire software. And he loved the way we talked on the radio. And you know, maybe we should do that online. That'd be really cool. And now you'll find something like 97% of all police departments are on Twitter because it's really a perfect tool for us as far as social media goes.
Well, good. Yeah. So this brings me to, you know, you recently wrote an article on why police departments need to prepare for disinformation. And it's a fascinating article. It makes me think, though, if, you know, you mentioned a lot of the police departments, some of them may or may not be particularly worried about certain crimes or certain issues going on in their jurisdiction. It makes me wonder that if they're not doing that, you know, Russian robots aren't going to be on their radar either. It can be kind of an uphill climb, I got to imagine, to bring this to the forefront and get people to listen to you when it just doesn't seem to be on anybody's radar right now.
Yeah. So let's pretend we get a little time machine and we're going to pop off into the future a little bit. And we're going to visit a police department, like an average police department, let's say 40 officers somewhere in the Midwest, and not like a technology heavy area, not a university heavy area, just like, you know, like a regular American community, really average. Imagine you're working there at the front desk and a young woman comes walking in and she says, oh, I need your help. I have to talk about something. This is really sensitive. And this, you know, this happens all the time. And you, okay, let's go over here and we'll talk privately. And she'll tell you, my ex-boyfriend or my ex-husband, whatever, put out a video of me, a pornographic video. And he's sharing it with people all over the place. But I never did that video. That's not me. It's a fake video, but it looks exactly like me. And it sounds like me and it seems real, but that's not me. But he's sending it all over the place. What can I do? Now come back to today and ask people, when that happens at your police departments, what are you going to do about it? Have you thought of that? Like that's called deepfake technology. Mm-hmm. Minutes just ran a story the other night about deepfakes, but it's been around for a while now. People are more aware of it now. So when I show the videos, people are less amazed. Like when I first started showing them, they're like, wow. But now some people are like, oh yeah, I saw this. But think of deepfakes. That's something that's really difficult to do right now. It costs a lot of money. You need some really good computers, some technical skill. But in a couple of years, what happens with computers? They get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. They get more powerful. And the software gets easier and easier to use. So even if you're a dummy, you can figure out, oh, I just put someone's face in this video and then I hit this button and it'll turn it into a real video, right?
Yeah.
That's what's coming. So how does that affect us?
Yeah. And there's also software out there that will mimic your voice.
Yeah.
As well.
It'll all be one package. Mm-hmm. Someone's going to take, you know, if we were doing a video podcast right now, you and I, they could take a clip of the video and turn it into all kinds of deep fake videos. They could have me, you know, doing anything. They could have you doing anything. But now imagine this is coming. This is not something I'm making up. This is coming. It's coming soon, but it's going to be common. It'll be so easy to do. And think about, what are these jerks, these domestic violence guys, right? They do these awful things. They all do these awful things. It's like a book they all read, like how to do awful things. This is an awful thing that they're going to do. What are you going to do right now when this woman comes walking into your lobby with this problem? What are we doing now about it? Because it's coming. What laws do you have? Do you have a law now in your state? What are you going to charge this guy with? Is this even illegal? It could be perfectly legal right now in some states. What do you tell her? Civil court. Go to civil court and sue him. And then he goes to civil court and he says, no, this is her. I just accidentally lost the video. This is real. You know what I mean? Like, how about this? You're in court. You accuse someone of a crime and you're like, hey, here's the video of them doing the robbery at the bank. No, Your Honor, I have a video of me at being a customer at another store. Yeah. Well, that could be a deep fake video, right? So we get into court dealing with all these things. How about this? Now we go to court. We have a video of someone doing something and they go, no, that's not real. That's fake. Everyone knows about deep fake videos now, and that's a fake video. And then that just carries over into everything in society. So you look at all the political strife and everything now, when you add deep fake, good quality deep fake videos to it, nothing will be believable anymore. Police chief says, hey, my officer never shot that person. That viral video is showing right now. What are you going to do when that happens? Oh, the Burlington police last night shot somebody at the Burlington Mall. Look at this awful video. And it's a deep fake video. It could be, you know, as fake as anything, but people, you think they're going to say, oh, right away, they're going to believe it. And you may be dealing with protesters because that will come quickly. And they're going to be protesting a video that never happened.
So what do you suggest police departments do?
So I've been giving this a lot of thought. It's going to be really hard. It's going to be a challenge. So I would today, right now, start building a network. And I think a great example, if you've ever read Team of Teams, General Stanley McChrystal wrote this. You can look up, he's written articles, but basically the premise is when the United States was over in Afghanistan, they were battling against a network. And our military had been set up to fight major wars against superpowers, right? Like Russia, or mm-hmm. Soviet, I should say. Now they're dealing with a network consisting of networks of people. And it's unconventional and it's very complicated. And are you going to beat them with your traditional structure? No, it takes a network to defeat a network. So I would say today, right now, police departments should be building their network. You should be teaming up with other police departments, with other agencies that are credible, that have good reputations, and that when that day comes, when somebody says, oh, your police department did XYZ, and you come out and say, no, we didn't do that, and that's a fake video, that people will believe you. Now, if you try to do that on your own today, it's not going to work. But if you have a lot of allies out there that can help you, your network, you can spread that information. So the disinformation is going to spread, like lies will spread online about 7 times faster than the truth. Okay. And that's multiple studies have shown this. Fake information goes 6 to 7 times faster and further than real information. So to stop that, you're going to have to get information out quickly. So one move we did here in our dispatch center, we have TweetDeck running right in our dispatch center. So you can look up and you can kind of see what people are talking about on Twitter. If I had my way, I would have my dispatch center set up like MEMA bunker, right? MEMA is the Mass Emergency Management Agency. Every state has the giant command centers with tons of monitors and things. I would have my dispatch center set up with lots of social media monitoring, real time. So you look up and you see a fake story going out, you respond to it right away. And then you get your network to help you spread the true information. And you got to start building that network now. And that will include your local media and any trusted agencies and groups out there. Because if you can't spread that story quickly, the false story is going to spread a lot faster than you're ready for. And you can't have your social media officer or PIO, whoever, is home and in bed. And the story's going out and you're like, well, they're not back in until Monday. Yeah, too late. Right. You gotta have a plan now for this because it's coming and it's already happened in some places. You have to be on top of these things. And I would say I like to read about strategy, and Sun Tzu, The Art of War is a good book, and think about strategies. You know, you want to have a big following on social media. Some police departments are afraid to get on there. They're afraid to talk. They only use it every once in a while. Well, you should be trying to engage people all the time. And you want a big following because, again, when you need to put out true information, you want a big audience. And the way you build that audience, you can do it different ways, but maybe more useful information all the time. Maybe humor. You know, you got to be careful with that. But there's a way to get a good following online so that when lies are going out, you can get the truth out. And the most important thing out of all these things is that you have to have integrity. Your agency can never, ever, ever, ever put out something that's inaccurate or wrong. Because if you do that, you're going to lose people's trust and you're going to have a very, very, very hard time getting it back. So you need a lot of credibility. You need a big network that works with you. Hopefully, when this does happen to you, you'll be able to respond quickly and get the truth out quickly. And keep in mind, you're going to be in a losing position right from the very start. You're going to be 6 or 7 steps behind the bad guys that are putting out information.
That's certainly a topic we could go on and on and on about. So I'm going to quickly switch subjects. So I do want to talk briefly about the IACA. So you were recently named chair of the Regional Associations Committee. One of the ideas that I have is that, you know, when you get a new analyst with IACA, they should automatically be assigned to a local association as well. And that it's kind of like no analyst left behind kind of thing. And that that local association can do a better job of welcoming a new analyst to the association more than the IACA can, because the IACA does a lot of things and it's international. And so you certainly don't want to leave anybody behind per se, but the local association, getting the analysts tied to local associations, I think would be very helpful in getting that analyst started. And so just wanted to get your viewpoint mainly on the new region associations as a whole, but even answering that question of getting new association members assigned to local regions.
Yeah, I agree with that. If there is a regional in that person's area, because we do have large parts of the country, you know, that there is no regional association nearby for those people. They may be these little islands all by themselves. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, a lot of regionals do cover a lot of areas where most of our analysts are. So that is one of the ideas out there. So what we're trying to do is make sure the IACA, like, for example, can we go to one place and find out who the board members are of each of the regional associations? Can we go to one place and find the website for each regional association and updated contact information, including their executive board members? Can we look at things to help the regional associations? Because some people have started these associations and they failed, right? If you start a nonprofit professional association, it's more than just saying, oh yeah, we're going to collect dues and we're going to meet every month and we'll just put the money somewhere in a bag on a shelf, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to it. So how about coming up with a packet so that if somebody wants to start a brand new association, how do they do that? And we've helped already a few places start their own associations. How about some sample bylaws? Like, what bylaws do you need in place? How do we build those associations up? How do we help them where not every association does a conference? And they're wondering, like, how do you do a conference? You know, like, that's a big deal, right? It's not sure. Like, you just start tomorrow. Oh, we're going to have a conference. Well, how do you do that? So maybe putting together a packet that every association has of sort of like best practices and how to do things. How do we do monthly meetings? What are the challenges that you have running a monthly meeting? Well, one of the biggest problems is getting people to speak at them. So maybe what have other associations done to address that problem? A lot of people are willing to host at their agency, but not a lot of people are willing to get up in front of people and talk to people about a particular topic. Maybe you find good speakers. Maybe we've had some great speakers at our conference and some other associations say, hey, we're trying to fill our lineup for our conference. Who did you have and how were they? And how do you get in touch with them? So we can all help each other with all that stuff and how to manage the association effectively. Like I said earlier, member management systems. So I don't even know if I'm allowed to say this, but the IACA is looking at member management systems. So
I won't tell.
Yeah. It's a great way to run a nonprofit professional association. It handles a lot of your back end stuff that's a real pain in the ass for unpaid volunteers to have to do. So we can help people improve their processes, their practices. Hey, you use Wild Apricot. Hey, you use MemberClicks. Which one do you like better? We can come up with all that information. What are the pros and cons of each system out there? How much does it cost you? And we can answer a lot of questions so other associations don't have to do as much research. And because we're all volunteers, right? I don't know of anybody who's paying people to manage all this stuff for them. But when you have like volunteers who already work in jobs where they're really busy already, and they're trying to get as much free time as they can to help out with these other things, it would be great to have this network, a team of teams. Look at that. We just did a call back to that.
There you go.
A team of teams that we're all helping each other and working together to make sure we have the best professional groups that we can have, and then all work more cooperatively with the International Association and what are the things that they can do to kick back to help the regionals as well. And as we all grow, they say like a rising tide raises all ships.
Mm-hmm.
As we all grow, it's the best thing for all of us, including the International Association.
So this almost sounds like it's a website that does a little bit more, meaning that it's getting more involved in the business of the association to help out the association in the background. Is that a good understanding?
Yeah, it'd be kind of like, you know, the state governments and the federal government in the United States. The states do a lot of stuff, but the feds, they're able to do different things. And in our case, the IACA is like the federal government. They've got a lot of resources and a lot more money, and they can put on a big conference, and they can do certification and accreditation. They can do a lot of things, put on classes. The regionals, they're not as big, they have less of a budget, but they're local. They have more contacts locally, and they can put together local events, and they can put together, you know, local work with the international to bring that international training to the local event and actually advertise it locally and fill it up with local people. Symbiotic relationship that, you know, MACA and the IACA have always had a really good relationship. We've had a lot of IACA board members come to our conferences over the years, and we've had some of our board members really involved with the IACA back and forth. So every association should have that. And I think it will benefit everyone by having more of that information put together in one place so that you don't have to ask all 3,000 people on the IACA list, hey, how do you start an association? You can actually say, oh, here it is. Let me go to the website and let me talk to the experts here, and I'll get that information right away from all of them.
Okay. So with the associations, you talked about all the different ways and issues that an association can come run into and how other associations can help. I would imagine this gets more complex when you're talking about the development of an international regional association.
Yeah, I mean, we already have the IACA, and fortunately they've been around a long time. But when you start your own association for anything, right? A couple of years ago, my wife and I were on a local committee to start a dog park here in my town. And everyone thought, oh, it's simple. We'll just have some meetings, we'll do some stuff. And you try to explain to people, no, you actually, there are steps that you need to take. You need to establish a nonprofit association. You need to have bylaws. You need to figure out how you're going to handle money, because that's the big one. Mm-hmm. You got money coming in. If you're not handling it properly, then your treasurer can go to jail, or the treasurer and the president go to, you know what I mean? Like, you get into a lot of trouble and you can hurt your cause. So when you're going to set up something new, or let's say you have an established association that's been around a long time, but like in our case, we had a past board member who had passed away, and there was a lot of paperwork that was floating around out there that we couldn't find, and a lot of things we didn't know. So we had to rebuild a lot of things and register with our Secretary of State in Massachusetts and establish, oh yeah, we had to update, here are our bylaws, and we had to update, here are our financial statements. And then you also have to deal with the federal government. If you're in the US, you have to file 990 tax forms every year. And you have to have processes in place to make sure if, God forbid, you have a treasurer who maybe steals money, well, if you don't have good accounting practices in place, they can get away with that for many years. And my police department's dealt with some of the nonprofits in town. We've had people who were embezzling money. And typically it starts out as, oh, I was just borrowing the money and I was going to put it back. And they keep borrowing the money. At some point, you can never pay it back and it becomes a grand larceny.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have good procedures in place and accountability and a structure. And you need a place to store your documents so that if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, Mac is still going to keep running because I've set it up that way. So we'll have a Google Drive with all of our documents that other people can access all the time. We have the nonprofit stuff is all set up. We have the member management system is all set up. Multiple people can access it and run it. And we all can see what's going on at all times. So nobody can steal money because you're going to see it. So you have to build your associations, or if you already have a built association, you have to develop it into a machine that can run on its own when you replace some of the parts, right? So we're going to put a new driver in the seat of the car. And when the new driver's in there, they know how to drive the car. And the new passenger knows how to operate the windows and the radio, and the thing's going to keep moving. Because if you don't have all of that built, your association could die when one member wins the lottery and says, okay, I'm out of here. I'm going to the Bahamas and goodbye. The whole entire professional group that's been around for years will just wither away, right? So you have to have all these things in place. And I think this regional associations committee, that's the mission of it. It's to make sure all the regionals have the resources that they need to succeed, and that we're all going to work more closely together and cooperate more, and that the IACA will play their role in helping us and we can play our role in helping them.
Good. So are you going to Chicago next year for the IACA conference? Do you know?
Yeah, I am planning on going. I'm looking forward to it.
We should do the trivia night again.
Oh, yeah. People love and hate trivia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we should put it together. It's been a couple of years since you and I have done it. If you're up for it, I'll put a bug in somebody's ear, Albert Mesa's ear, and see if they're game for a trivia night. But since you and I have done trivia in the past, I thought we would play Quick Queries, which is a segment that I haven't done in a while on this show. So these are rapid fire questions. You're either given a choice or it's a one word answer. Right. And so the whole idea is this put you on the hot seat and to answer the question as quickly as possible.
It'd be tough for me because I always have multiple answers.
Yeah. So it's just real quick and no explanations. Right. Okay. It's just, it's either or, and we move on to the next question. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So here we go. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
Yes.
Would you rather be motorcycling on the highway or in a four wheeler in the mud in the woods?
Motorcycle.
Which is better, Boston Harbor in the spring or the fall?
Fall.
Is the ski mask symbol the best symbol for robberies and burglaries on a map?
Yes.
Would you rather have a beach house or a lake house?
Lake house.
If you were to set up an office anywhere in the world, where would it be?
Boston.
Peanut butter or jelly?
Peanut butter.
Which is worse, not being recognized for your work or being known for making a data error?
Being known for making a data error.
When you're at the movies, are you candy or popcorn?
Candy.
Is it wrong for a vegetarian to eat animal crackers?
No.
If you could go back in time, would you choose to be 16 or 25?
16.
Which is worse, an analyst thinking they know it all but don't, or an analyst not knowing but should?
The know-it-all.
More impressive, Burlington's landlocked forest or Burlington's motto, where technology goes to work?
The landlocked forest.
What's more annoying as a Patriots fan, Deflategate or Spygate?
Deflategate.
What's more likely, the U.S. gets fully vaccinated for COVID or all 18,000 police chiefs in America agree on one issue?
The chiefs agreeing.
All right, now I got five questions left. These deal with headlines. And so you're going to tell me whether it is a real headline or a fake headline. Okay.
Fun.
And then, so we're going to go through these, and then I'll give you the real answers after we're done with all five of them. Okay.
Sounds good.
All right. So the first one is NASA is installing internet on the moon. Is that real or fake?
Real.
A university banned the use of capital letters to avoid scaring students. Real or fake?
That's fake.
Police in Germany rescue man chased by baby squirrel. Real or fake?
I can believe that one because we've had calls of squirrels.
So is that real or fake?
Yeah, I'll go real.
Criminal farts so loudly he gives away his hiding place. Real or fake?
Oh, that has definitely happened.
And finally, Skittles used instead of salt to help clear ice and snow from roads in Canada. Real or fake?
That's fake.
Okay, very good. You got 100% on those. So yes, NASA is installing internet. And they're not banning capital letters at any university. And there was a guy that was chased by a baby squirrel and one that farted too loud. But they are not using Skittles for anything on the roads in Canada. So very good, Glenn.
That's all my experience in misinformation and real world application right there.
All right. Well, our last segment to the show is Words to the World. And this is where I give the guests the last word and you can promote any idea that you wish. Glenn, what are your words to the world?
Well, I have a few things I would promote. I would say, you know, check out Police Futurists International. If you're looking for some really fun discussions about some really things that people might find a little bit out there, but looking towards the future, I would make sure you renew your membership dues and whatever association you belong to, because that's always something that associations are dealing with, is tracking people down to get their dues. And I would check out the MACA conference coming up in May of 2022. And if you're interested in free stuff, my website is opensourcepolicing.org, and I'm on Twitter at @OSPolicing. And follow MACA and the IACA and PFI all on Twitter. That's where I spend a lot of my time, my free time.
Well, I leave every guest with you giving me just enough to talk bad about you later.
Yep.
But I do appreciate you being on the show, Glenn. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcasts.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.